So go ahead, Ron.
This is Ron Borzakowski from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
This is Alexis Simmendinger from the FCIC's writing team. Good morning.
And today is September 28th. Damon, you joined us.
I did. Sorry, I'm running a little late then.
No problem. We are interested in your views, Senator, on the financial crisis and the role of housing policy as it played out over the crisis. First, what we like to do, if we may, is get a sense of your personal background from education on forward.
Okay, my name is Mel Martinez. Full legal name is Melquiades Martinez, but anyway, I am, educationally speaking, went to graduated from Florida State University with a bachelor's degree in international affairs and economics. I then went to Florida State University College of Law, graduated with a law degree. I practiced law in Orlando for 25 years. During that time, as part of my volunteer activities, I'm just going to give you relevant information, I think. I was chairman of the Orlando Housing Authority I was on the board and chaired it within a total of about 5 years of serving on that.
And when would that have been, please? Roughly?
When?
Roughly.
That would have been about 1983 to 1986 or something like that.
Okay.
In the mid-80s. I then was mayor of Orange County and then was asked by President Bush to serve as his first Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. I took office on January 22nd or 3rd of 2001, and I was Secretary of HUD until December the 12th of 2003. I then was candidate to the U.S. Senate. I was elected to the Senate in January of 2005 and served until September 9th of 2009. I was on the banking committee all of the time that I was in the Senate. And I think that's all the relevant stuff that I can give you.
That sounds pretty good. Thank you. I guess, why don't we start with your experiences at HUD, if we might. It was interesting that you worked on RESPA reform, and I'm curious if there's any relationship in your mind between disclosures of the RESPA type and the way the mortgage part of the financial crisis unfolded.
Well, let me say that I became intrigued about the cumbersome nature of the settlement process, the difficulty that an average American would have in understanding the reams and reams of documents that they would be asked to sign, most of those imposed by HUD regulations, having little meaning to the participant, and at the same time masking for actual disclosure. The fact of the matter is that I think the thing that attracted me to RESPA reform was that we obviously were interested in increasing home ownership among Americans. One of the biggest challenges people met was the difficulty in making a down payment. The settlement costs obviously were part of that. In addition to the down payment, they added to that difficulty. And if I got into it for those reasons, it became apparent to me that there were other problems. Disclosure problems, particularly. Junk fees found their way into the settlement process, in addition to the Norton charges by the title industry, which, of course, are still there today. I felt like stronger disclosures would allow the consumer to be better informed. And so as it relates to your work and not getting off into all the other good things that would have happened from a full-fledged RESPA reform like I envisioned, and almost got done. The fact is that I think it would have been greater disclosure. I think there would have been a better understanding of what an ARM really meant to a consumer and that type of thing. Now, obviously none of that would overcome the type of lax underwriting standards that came into the marketplace later, but that obviously will come at a later time in our conversation, I presume.
Yep.
I was very frustrated in my efforts to implement RESPA reform. The opposition was brutal, was fierce, and it was really shaking the foundations of an industry where a lot of people make a lot of money, or were at the time. So I did my best. I left it unfinished when I left. And my successor, Alfonso Jackson, and I know you'll probably be talking to him, he implemented some RESPA reforms, but they were not nearly as deep and as dramatic as what I had envisioned. In terms of the impact, I think it's only about consumer information. I think that I think it's tangential to the problem that we have all lived through. I don't think it's a direct connection there, but I do think that better disclosure would lead to better consumer information, and it could have led, in some cases, to better decisions by consumers.
For those of us who have not engaged in the kind of effort you're describing with RESPA, you talked about the really intense pressure. Can you describe the forms that that kind of pressure takes and what happens when you're trying to do something that you have a pretty good vision is a really good idea? What happens? How does this pressure play out on a decision maker?
Well, you feel it from different directions. As a cabinet member, you feel it from the White House. I fortunately had forged a good relationship with President Bush on this issue and a lot of others, and he understood what I was up to, and he was very supportive. But there's every interest group that is impacted by it will weigh in, and weigh in heavily. There are congressional people who are in positions of authority who will assure you that it'll impact your budget, that it'll impact appropriations. There's a myriad of ways in which it can. You know, RESPA is an administrative and regulatory thing. You could do RESPA reform without legislative changes, but it isn't about the legal nicety of it, it's about the reality of it. And so there's no question in my mind that there was going to be a heavy price to be paid. I was willing to do it because I worked for the president, and he had my back on this issue. But, I know that one of the most vehement opponents was the title industry. I think, you know, but it's really, this has more to do with the cost of the process than it does with anything that would precipitate a financial crisis like we saw.
I understand. I was just, because you had such a unique view, it was good to get a perspective of what that kind of pressure looks like, even when somebody in a position of authority has a pretty good idea of what might work best for consumers and ultimately for the industry. So thank you. That's quite helpful.
Yeah, no, it was a circling of the wagons by every housing-related group, you know. They go into a headwind pretty much.
Well, let's shift to another headwind. Can you describe at HUD your relationship with Fannie and Freddie?
Where shall we begin? let's just say that I was a HUD secretary that early on had the benefit of talking about Fannie and Freddie. Look, let me first of all say that when I came to HUD, I knew nothing about Fannie and Freddie. I remember getting a call from Mr. Johnson congratulating me on the position. He was out of Fannie at the time when Mr. Raines had taken over, but, you know, and that began an immediate and aggressive courtship that I felt all along from Fannie and much more Fannie than Freddie and their friends. I early on met Mr. Wollaston, who I know is on your commission, had a pretty good understanding of how he viewed the GSEs and the dangers that they posed and the challenges to the entire financial system. I spoke with people like Alan Greenspan, who shared concerns for systemic challenges that these entities could pose to the economy, and just a number of other people who were contrarian voices, I guess, from the whole army of lobbyists that continually paraded in a bipartisan fashion through my offices or anywhere I was, you know. It's pretty amazing the number of people that were in their employ. I became convinced that as a partial regulator of Fannie and Freddie, with a fail under HUD but not really directly responding having some responsibility, and the perception of the regulator, which in fact recited at OFAIL, and with me having very little authority to do much of anything. So I became challenged by the fact that these entities had a tremendous hand in the housing finance industry. They were tremendously positive, viewed positively, but yet they presented a possible systemic risk, and there were some very obvious things about them that were of concern. So I became concerned about the areas that I could impact. I wasn't responsible for their safety and soundness. That resided solely within OFAIL. And let me touch on that. It became apparent to me immediately that OFAIL was underfunded and undermanned, and their mission was very limited. And it became clear to me that that's exactly how Fannie and Freddie wanted it. And they had the power and wherewithal in the Congress to keep it that way. My mission in regulation was more relating to product approval and housing goals. I mostly dealt with the product approval issue because they were continually, I was hearing from others in the marketplace feeling that there was an unfair competition by Fannie and Freddie with an implied government guaranteed, which gave them at least a 25 basis point advantage in the marketplace, and that they were moving into areas far afield from their original mission. Great concerns about their portfolio investments, great concerns about their undercapitalization, but as it pertained to my world, great concern about mission creep, if you will. The way it was handled is that they could begin a new product, have it in the marketplace, and then they would say, do you have a problem with this? By then already it was out and about, and that just didn't seem to be a good way to run a railroad to me. And so the relationship was cordial at times, but plenty rocky as time went on, because I became convinced that we needed to develop a stronger regulatory scheme for Fannie and Freddie. I went to the White House early on and talked to Domestic Policy Council folks, Larry Lindsey, who was chair of the President's Economic Council. Initially, there was a lukewarm reception of the White House about my getting too far afield on this. And mind you, as I came into HUD, I recall in my confirmation hearings sort of begging off from the GSEs because of their deep, deep controversy and the fact that I knew so little about them. And so I deferred any questions on them, and the senators in the banking committee at the time were kind enough not to dwell on it, and we sort of agreed that that was just an area I would get into later. But I did get into later, and I did become very knowledgeable of them and develop some pretty strong opinions. And so my point in saying that is that I didn't come in with any preconceived notions or any preconceived ideas about them, but I developed them as I went along. And so that developed into a fairly, I don't know what the word would be, but we had a tough relationship because I wanted to instill a new regulatory framework for them. Finally, after some conversations with the White House, and not just me, but others as well, from outside the administration, I presume, and whatever, it became much more of a concerted effort by the administration. And then Secretary Snow and I put our people together. We came up with a proposed new regulatory framework for Fannie and for the GSEs. We went to the Hill to testify on this. This by then is late on in my time at HUD, but it was in this was in October of 2003, it was in fact well received by some and aggressively challenged by others. Our idea was that there had to be a much stronger regulator, that these entities were essentially unregulated, and that they posed a systemic risk to the economy, and that they constituted about a $1.4 trillion in potential challenges to what was then referred to as an implied guarantee, but no one doubted for a moment that it was in fact an explicit guarantee of the Treasury to back these entities. So anyway, that's sort of an overview. I'm happy to delve into any more detail in any area you wish.
Thank you. Why don't we, if we might, it's interesting to me that you started at HUD before your understanding of the need for new legislation, with the idea that HUD didn't have, as I think you put it, not much authority to do anything, sort of limited capacity and product approval and the housing goals, and yet you perceived early, if I heard you right, that you were already being cultivated by lobbyists for the two GSEs. I'm curious, again, from the perspective of a HUD secretary, what it looked like in the beginning when you were basically a blank slate, ready to learn about the GSEs, what the influence efforts looked like by the GSEs, and then moving forward as they suddenly perceived that you had concerns about their regulatory structure.
It was a fairly constant drumbeat of people at any typical Washington social setting who would let you know that they did some work with Fannie and Freddie, and Fannie usually, how important they were, and if I ever had any problems or issues to let him know, could they come see me, talk to me about them. Franklin Raines would come not frequently, but occasionally come to see me. It was very, very poignant that you're talking about the early parts, so I'll leave it there. I mean, we can talk about the latter parts as well. I began to get aggressive about legislation and how that was handled. But in the early part, it was more what you would call schmoozing, maybe, just friendly conversation. But it became apparent to me that there was a lot of people in town that cared about the GSEs.
Any offers to go to ribbon cuttings or do other things to...
Well, sure. That was another part of it. Immediately you get invitations to go to Fannie Mae Foundation sponsor events. I mean, it was startling to me that they had a hook in every community in America where there was a Fannie Mae representative there, and that this person would put on an event, and if we needed the loudspeakers and whatever. I mean, there were sort of joint events, if you will. It just happened that way. That's just the way things were done. I wasn't cognizant of, any conflict of interest at all because, you show up in Detroit or you show up in Chicago or you show up in Miami and the Fannie person is there, and next thing you know, the tent that's there was provided by Fannie, and it's a Fannie project that you're there to tout and highlight, A lot of inner city stuff, a lot of the Fannie Mae Foundation stuff. You're just kind of going through the motions and not really aware of the pervasive nature of their influence. Because they weren't asking me to do anything or quid pro quo or anything like that. It wasn't anything like that. It was just that they were everywhere that you did. Anything you had to do with housing, Fannie Mae was there.
What about...
In some way. You went to speak at a conference, there'll be a Fannie Mae person at the head table shaking your hand. That kind of thing.
What about the other way around? When HUD had an initiative, the original theory of Fannie Mae, it was part of HUD eons ago, was that it would be an arm of government policy in housing. When you had something you needed to do at HUD, to what extent could you call on the GSEs to help you carry it out?
That's not something I recall doing, reaching out to them and asking. I think we might have informed of an initiative or something like that, but no, I think where I saw their influence, and as I look back upon it, I think in a fairly negative light, is how influential they were with members of Congress. not only by what they may have written to them as checks, but what became to me very clear was the fact that there, all of a sudden, there was a very nice 40-unit apartment building in somebody's congressional district that perhaps was built on property owned by somebody that was important, and perhaps it was done in partnership or financing for someone who also happened to be important to the person who was a member. So, I mean, that I thought was kind of smelly.
So
but I don't recall personally reaching out to them to have them be a part of an initiative. That's just not something I recall. I mean, it could have happened. I don't have a recollection of that.
And they weren't offering, I take it.
I don't recall. They might have, but I don't recall specifically.
And so then why don't we move forward? We were talking about the beginning phase when suddenly it became clear that you cared about issues like product approval and then ultimate and mission creep and ultimately systemic risk and the need for a new regulatory framework. How did the tone change?
Well, the tone changed, and it was obvious that they were very much against it and that they would array their forces in the Congress, and which were considerable, in opposition. I remember at some point as this process moved forward, I was idealistic enough to think that maybe we could get this done. And so moving the legislation forward, I remember at some point or another having the leadership of Fannie Mae, and I don't recall if this was Dan Mudd, if it was Franklin Raines, or if it was both, suggesting to me that they would work with me on legislation and that, yes, they too agreed that a stronger regulator was a good thing because it would provide more credibility to the marketplace, make it easier for them to raise funds and continue to fulfill their mission. That was a complete falsehood, and they, in fact, while telling me that they were going to be somehow cooperative and collaborative, were on the other side on Capitol Hill doing everything they could to kill the legislation. And that was frustrating and disappointing to me. We had the congressional hearings on it. I have reviewed the transcript, a couple of things that, you know, I think would probably... I mean, I think it's very interesting that in all of this, there was a certain suspicion that our purposes were not pure and that, in fact, they were more motivated by there being some sort of a perceived anti-Fannie Freddie bias, you know, which I'm not sure why that would be the case, but that was the perception, and so that this regulation was meddling with something that was a finely tuned machine, and why mess with it, you know? And so that was sort of the reception that the legislation received in the Congress, with some exceptions. I'd say Congressman Baker was a voice in the wilderness from Louisiana, and Senator Sununu, a later colleague and co-sponsor of the legislation that ultimately passed. Let's see. So I don't know where I was. But
well, let me ask, because we're touching on members of Congress, was there ever an ability to reach across the aisle with something as sort of national interest as systemic risk?
Well, look, I think it was a fairly strong... negative reaction from all Democrats across the board and from some Republicans also. But I would say that we did not really ever reach the point where there was enough support among leadership for this to have a serious shot at moving forward. And I'm going to be hesitant to name in a negative light former colleagues or members of the House, but I would say that there was, when you look back on it, it was pretty clear that was going nowhere.
So
there was a pretty well, the deal was pretty well cooked, where it has to be cooked, which is at the levels of leadership in the committees, and that there was no real interest in pursuing this legislation, and that there was enough pressure brought to bear by the army of lobbyists that Fannie and Freddie employed and deployed, that was not going to have a chance.
Did you see any difference between Fannie and Freddie in the way they dealt with you as HUD secretary throughout this period?
I thought that in Freddie there was more honesty and candor and not nearly the duplicity that I saw in Fannie. And I think the intensity of the lobbying was much greater in Fannie, which I presume is since they were equally benefiting from it, that perhaps Freddie just let the bigger brother bear the laboring oar on that one. But I don't know. I mean, I'm speculating. I have no idea how that would have been the case. But I just sense less intensity from Freddie, as well as not the duplicity that I saw from Fannie.
There's one other area in your responsibility as HUD secretary, and that's the housing goals, the affordable housing goals. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I've done some retrospective on this because I knew this was an area of interest to you, and I could recall little or nothing to do with housing goals while I was there, although, I mean, I know that were an important part of what we did, but not an issue that I dealt with much. And I had a conversation with John Weicker, who was my housing commissioner and FHA commissioner and housing commissioner. And in our conversation, refreshed my recollection to the fact that I inherited housing goals that were set by my predecessor, Secretary Cuomo, who enacted them, and they became in effect in January of 2001, concurrent with my time beginning at HUD. Those were to be in place until the end of 2003, and we did not have sufficient time or resources, because we were very limited in resources as it related to this labor, to reset new housing goals. And so what was done in 2003 is that the 2003 goals, the existing goals, were extended for another year. And my understanding is that my successor then altered the housing goals, but that we did not touch on the housing goals at all during my time at HUD, and they were merely continued under my administration from what my predecessor had set. And having said that, as it relates to housing goals, it was an important part of the legislation that we were proposing. I was concerned about creating housing goals that were more meaningful. I thought that these goals, my concern, and I remember discussing this with Dr. Weicker and others, was that the GSEs could meet the housing goals in November to have them ready for December by merely doing something that wouldn't be prudent, which is purchasing mortgages that perhaps were below their usual underwriting standards, which during this time I think were appropriate. I think this changed later, but I think during this time were appropriate. And then maybe just bulking up on mortgages that they would hold for a period of time, meet the housing goals, and then dump back onto the market, or have a resale or a repurchase agreement with those that they purchased them from. And so we wanted to have sub-goals. We wanted to have more meaningful goals because, startling as it may seem, the GSEs lagged the private sector as it related to first-time homebuyers and minority homebuyers. And that seemed to be, you know, kind of completely at odds with their purpose and their goal. I mean, how can you have a government implied guarantee which gives you a 25 basis point advantage, and they have people in the marketplace who are beating you when it related to these goals? And anyway, I don't know. That was one of the imponderables. But we were trying to make it more meaningful in the legislation, but that never came to pass.
One last issue from the HUD period while you were secretary and with respect to the GSEs, and that is you mentioned new product approval, mission creep. Were there any large issues that ever came before HUD at that point where you had to make a tough call?
On the GSEs?
On new product approval on the GSEs, yeah.
Yeah, oh, I remember a controversy about a new product, and I can't remember the details of it now. That's not an area that I have reviewed in anticipation of this, but I have a recollection that we did have a round and round with them on an approval of a certain product, and I can't remember the details of it now. But we did confront them, and which was part of what prompted, I think, my strong desire to see legislation in this area. But I can't remember the details of it.
Okay. While we're talking about John Weicker, how was FHA doing at this point?
Very solid and sound. Had too small of a market share. But it was fiscally and financially sound. It was tried to run on an actuarial basis, meaning that premiums, had to bear some relationship to where we were. It had a strong, strong reserve, and I'd say north of $20 billion. But it was, the concern with us at the time was that it was dramatically losing market share to the private sector and perhaps not fulfilling the historic role that it had had. I think we were in a, 3% or less of mortgages, which was, we thought, too low, and that it worked to fulfill our mission. FHA probably ought to be a little more, have a larger market share, but there was no financial or fiscal issues, and we essentially just ran it.
Okay. And your sense of, the issue of the GSEs has always been, we are going to have private sector effectiveness compared to a government program, and FHA is a government program. Any sense of your sense of the capability of the people and systems and processes at FHA?
Well, that's an excellent question. This now may merge with knowledge acquired as a member of the banking committee, but there's no doubt in my mind that FHA systems were well integrated and personnel were at a minimum. I'm not going to speak to their qualifications because I really probably couldn't, but I would say certainly undermanned would be an understatement. And I think given what the market has done to them now, that I know that they not only face serious potential for not having the fiscal situation that I described a minute ago, but what it was in 2001, 2, and 3, but also that they don't have the tools to keep up with the challenges that they're facing today or the numbers of people who deal with the problems they're facing today.
Thank you. All right. So why don't we move to, unless my colleagues have questions about the period at HUD, why don't we move to your period as senator? And we're curious whether Fannie's and Freddie's approach to you changed in any way, either during the campaign or as you became a senator, and particularly since you said you went on the banking committee right away.
I don't recall them having a role in my campaign. I would imagine that there were contributions to my campaign by people that had a connection to them. I think I pretty well was out of the closet, if you will, as not being a sympathizer, so I don't think they ever viewed me during my time in the Senate as a likely ally. I don't recall, Dan Mudd was the new head of the entity at that time, and I suppose they came in to see me a time or two, but I don't recall any close working relationship with them or a lot of, I haven't said much calendars, but I imagine that when it was in my office, but I don't presume it was more than once or twice. And I do know that at some point I became a co-sponsor of the legislation with Senator Dole and Senator Sununu and myself. What did they say? They were all gone.
Yeah.
But anyway, obviously they didn't find favor with that, but I do recall a couple of hearings where I was fairly strong in questioning Mudd on issues. I think that their influence in the Congress is chronicled in many places, and I'm not probably the best to talk about that aspect of it. But I think government-sponsored enterprises, if they continue in the future, clearly ought to not have the kind of influence that they were able to garner through the Fannie Mae Foundation and through the kind of armies of lobbyists that they were able to get and have working for them then. They at one point hired my banking L.A., to work for them, Reagan Anderson, a very fine person, but she found a good job with them. I don't think she's any longer with them because I guess they don't do that function anymore. But I guess about a year or so after I was a senator, they hired her, and then she did come see me a couple of times, and I was always pleasant to her, and you know, that kind of thing.
That was Fannie or Freddie?
Fannie. I don't recall Freddie ever coming to see me as a senator, quite honestly. Actually, the new president, the Boston banker.
Oh, yeah, Dick Styron.
Styron, yeah. I remember meeting with him a couple of times, you know, whether it was at a dinner somewhere or whether it was actually in my office, but I recall. I thought he was a good, earnest fellow trying to clean up an accounting mess in his hands and that kind of thing. Remember thinking when the accounting fiasco began there, I remember Franklin Lane coming to my office at HUD and telling me that could never happen at Fannie, only to find out a year later that the same thing was happening at Fannie. Can I give you a couple of my big picture ideas of what I think their relationship to the big overall problem? I think personally that being way undercapitalized, having poor capital requirements was at the heart of a lot of this. And I think in my observation from the seat of the Senate that in 06, 07, I don't know exactly when, but that their underwriting standards changed dramatically and that they then began to play the game, I think, responsibly as a whole lot of other players. And I think that the rounding of numbers and the games they were playing to keep bonuses coming, as much as keeping investors interested by not being truthful with the marketplace, I think were horrible things that took place. I'm not going to make a judgment about whether it's a criminal act or not, but I think that it's something about which has not been enough said or talked about. And I think, in my mind, that their failure is intertwined directly to the overall fiscal catastrophe that we had. And, in fact, I think the need to bail them out, in many ways, was as a result of the fact that they were acting as if they had the full faith and credit of the United States Treasury, and they were selling their securities pretty much as if they were Treasury notes. And therefore, when you have sovereign wealth funds and important financial partners of this country that would have faced incredible losses, the financial rescue of these entities was something that was a necessary thing to do to maintain the fiscal credibility of the United States.
Can you expand on the idea that they weren't truthful with the marketplace? What does that mean?
Well, I'm not an auditor, but it seems to me that when they were both were cooking the books, they were essentially telling the marketplace that their returns were even and steady, and no matter what happened in the world, that you could expect a fairly good double-digit return to your investment. That, in fact, was only generated as a result of rounding of the ups and downs so that they could perform at a steady pace when, in fact, that was not their history. I think that was compounded as they heavily invested in their own portfolio. I mean, their portfolio is something they never should have had. I mean, that's not, you know, portfolio investment by these entities was not at all part of their mission. That should not have been in any way part of what GSEs did. And I think that created at doubling down on the risk of their own securities. And so, I don't know. I'm not a financial analyst, but that just seems to me that fundamental fairness would suggest that they need to tell those that are investing in their securities, we only had a 4% return last year. You know, maybe next year it'll be higher, but when they're telling you it's 10 when it really was 4, and they're just, you know, cooking the books to make it all look the same. And then also, I think the great crime is the compensation levels that these entities had and how they were tied to performance, but they were then, executives were designing everything they did to meet their compensation goals and not the safety and soundness of these entities. Which I think brings up another problem as we go forward and as you make your recommendations. I mean, I think that to have these entities be for private gain with a federal government guarantee just makes no sense, you know. I mean, if we ought to have GSEs, then at some point we hopefully will have a private sector market for securitized mortgages, and perhaps we don't need to continue to be tethered to these entities. But they should have either a public mission or a private mission, but not a hybrid.
Okay. The Fannie Freddie accounting failures, internal control failures, the steady Freddie idea of basically trying to rig earnings to report to investors. That happened while you were on the campaign trail. I mean, it's interesting. That happened in really... I guess you may still have been...
Freddie happened while I was still at HUD, because I remember Franklin Raines coming in to reassure me that... I mean, and I remember his words. That this could never happen with us. Because I was very concerned about them when the first shoe dropped, it was Freddie. So Freddie happened, I'm going to guess, in the fall of 2003. Before I left HUD.
Okay. Any sense that their influence diminished after that, or were they able to keep on going?
No, that was a remarkable thing to me. I thought if ever we're going to get a new regulator, it was a result of this. But you know what? Their influence was completely undiminished in the face of what was, in fact, fraudulent bookkeeping. I mean, their influence was completely undiminished.
That's amazing.
It is. It's amazing. I remember at the time just shaking my head and thinking, I can't believe these people are so powerful. But even now, I mean, I remember thinking, okay, this is our moment. We can get this done. And to no avail.
Let's go on to talk about your period on the banking committee, if we might. Are there other questions here about GSEs?
I have one going back to the first part.
Please.
Go
ahead. Yeah. Speak to the mic, yeah. We've been joined by Milana Vickers, who hadn't been here before. She's one of our writers.
Okay.
Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
I wonder if I can take you back to the point you were making earlier about housing policy and the observation that the private sector was providing more minority housing than was Fannie. And why it is that it wasn't more of a, you know, forgive me if I'm sort of overanalyzing this or mischaracterizing it, but I wonder why it wasn't more of a goal among Republicans to say, well, great, if the agency's mission is being effectively accomplished by the market, we should get the heck out. And instead, they have the opposite response, where they say, oh no, we need to be even more aggressive to compete against the private sector.
The problem is that you had an entity that had an unfair advantage to compete with the private sector, and that in fact part of what their mission was to fulfill certain housing goals. And when you see the private sector without the advantage fulfilling a larger share of that marketplace, then you say, what is your purpose? Your purpose was to fulfill that mission. So, in other words, it wasn't about doubling down on housing goals, at least not during my time. It was more about saying, you've got these goals others are meeting, others are exceeding what you're doing, what are you doing with your guarantee? You're using a public subsidy in order to gain an advantage in the marketplace so that you can do exotic products, so that you can get into the into business areas that the private sector should be doing. So stick to your knitting, improve your housing performance as it relates to first-time and minority home buyers. Don't be out there doing the exotic things that now unfairly compete with the private sector. So it was more about having them mind their business, mind their mission, than it was about trying to say, I mean, it was not a discussion or a debate between should you be private or not, because in that debate, I think there would have been a chorus of Republicans saying, sure, you ought to probably be private. But it was given the fact that there was an acknowledgement that they had a public mission and that there was a fairly good bipartisan consensus for now, maybe 40 years or 50 years, that they served a purpose, that their purpose really was what the charter indicated for them to do, not what the charter did not talk about, but that they were very busy trying to do in order to improve earnings, in order to improve bonuses.
Well, I guess I want you to be tough on Republicans. I want you to be tough on your own guys. Pretend I'm a reporter from the Tea Party newspaper, and I'm saying, you know, why aren't you guys asking for the elimination of HUD and the elimination of Fannie in 2000? You know, at the very first moment that it seems that lending to minorities and minority housing numbers are improving because of the private sector.
Well, I mean, look, the function of the GSEs was a little broader than just the housing goals and their mission to provide, I mean, you would just think that, it's just sort of counterintuitive that they would be lagging the private sector. But their mission was broader and wider, and they played an important role in the securitizing of mortgages, which brought a lot of infusion of money into the mortgage marketplace, which provided the low-cost mortgages that Americans have come to enjoy, and that fit very nicely into what was a hoped-for goal, which was to increase home ownership among all Americans. But, I mean, I don't know. You know, this was a bipartisan problem, by the way. There was no, I mean, I think that there's some people that distinguish themselves in their fervor of support for Fannie and Freddie who happen to be Democrats, but there was also a fairly strong bipartisan acknowledgement that no one wanted to tamper with these entities. I mean, save for Senator Sununu or a Congressman Baker or a few others, myself included, I guess, at some point. So I don't think this is a partisan issue. I think there's plenty of blame to go around bipartisanly. I mean, I have some favorite quotes from some Democrats, but I don't think that really is at the heart of what the problem here is. And if you're looking at how we got into this mess and how we do not repeat it in the future, I'm not so sure that housing goals and whether Fannie and Freddie were meeting them or not is at the heart of it. It was more about the inefficiency of the regulator that couldn't touch what obviously were unmet goals. I don't know if I'm answering your question or not.
Thank you.
You know, I was thinking back when you'd sort of described your big picture, in particular 06 and 07, where Fannie and Freddie, as undercapitalized institutions with a weak regulator and a mixed private-public mission, I think your expression was double down or you know, take on a whole lot of risk, especially given those capital levels. In that discussion, unlike some others, you didn't mention, you almost describe a very private motive and a compensation motive to that behavior. In your mind, is that true? As opposed to in 2006 and 2007, in order to meet the new aggressive goals and to keep up with lending, you know, Fannie and Freddie had to do it
for market share or some other reason.
I really am not in a position to speak to the housing goals that came in after I left HUD.
Okay.
Again, it's not something that I legislatively dealt with, or even I don't think at the time, concurrent with the time that I was cognizant of any dramatic change in their housing goals, and how that was impacting their behavior. But I, if their underwriting standards altered, in my opinion, I did not think it was to meet housing goals that were now more stringent, because they were able to meet them with relative ease by jiggling the numbers at the year end. And by that I mean acquiring mortgages, selling them back, and things like that. And HUD did not have the ability, in my understanding, to make these housing goals more enforceable or prevent them from buying and then selling back. So I think that to suggest that housing goals had much of a role in their behavior, that's not consistent with my knowledge of the entities or the facts as I knew them.
So I appreciate that. So you do, just to understand correctly, I mean, you really did put the onus on the very low capital requirements, the very large portfolio, and aggressive, it sounds, highly compensated structure at those institutions.
I think that's at the very heart of their failure. I think that if they dropped their underwriting standards dramatically, I would look at that as being part of the problem, too. Although I don't know, you know, I don't think I could speak to the reasons why they did. There may be others that know the situation better.
Mm-hmm. If we can go on to your position on the banking committee, and to make a segue from the GSEs to the mortgage market generically, the commission has released a couple of documents internal to Fannie Mae that say 2005, say we have two choices here. Either we stay the course with our traditional credit standards or we drop them. If we stay the course with our traditional credit standards, we lose market share. And the market was changing at that point. And Fannie and Freddie, particularly after their accounting failures, had lost market share after the refi boom in 2003. I'm curious what it looked like from the banking committee in terms of how the market was developing, the Countrywides of the world, the Wall Street firms that were moving forward to get product for securitizations, sort of that part of the market that the GSEs felt themselves forced to react to.
You know, I don't think that from my vantage point on the banking committee that I had enough of a window into that to be able to make any comment that would be helpful to you.
So there weren't people running around saying, gee, we've got a housing bubble, we better do something.
Now, you know, I can remember talking to a lot of economists while I was at HUD who would unanimously tell you that there was no such possible thing as a housing bubble because the housing market was regional in nature and there could never be a national bubble as such. But anyway, I don't recall that being something that people were concerned about. Or, I mean, don't forget, we're there to legislate, and if there was not a piece of legislation dealing with those issues, the only legislation really in those days was back to a stronger regulator for Fannie and Freddie that we perceived there was a need for, and the legislation languishing until we finally passed in, was it 07?
08.
08, 08.
3 months before they went down.
Right. Almost in time to save them.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ron.
I was just thinking, Senator, you mentioned when you started sort of talking about the bigger themes, at least in Fannie and Freddie, it was the capitalization and this aggressive behavior. Do you have particular views, you know, also sort of broader views of the evolution of the crisis, of what got us to this point, you know, starting whenever? I mean, over the 2000s or earlier? I mean, sort of your general theme and motif for this crisis?
I lived through it in the days, in the darkest of days, as a member of the banking committee, so I frequently heard from Bernanke and Paulson and others, and Geithner, I guess, too. And, you know, I think a lot has been written on this already, and I've read some of it. I don't know that I can say there's any one thing for sure that really caused it, but I would say the GSE's role in this cannot be underestimated or diminished. I think that they played a very, very substantial role in creating what became a freezing of the credit markets. The credit markets began to lose confidence in one another, and I got to believe that securitized mortgages were very much at the heart of it. And the great large positions that institutions had in them, and the inability to price them and therefore to buy them and sell them, very much, I think, played a very substantial role in everything else that cratered from then on.
Okay. A couple of our people have some questions. Go ahead, Alexis. Okay.
Senator, this is Alexis. I have a quick question for you. When you were at HUD, of course, the administration was very supportive of increasing minority home ownership, and you talked very assertively about the president's goal, and he did too. You also at the time talked about how subprime lending was not necessarily bad, and you were very encouraging to the private market to be thinking about the
bill. What kind of lending?
Subprime lending.
Oh, okay.
And you also encouraged the private marketplace to try to think about building homes for low income. Can you talk about anything that you saw in the private sector that may have looked like a migration of thinking about subprime lending that grew out of the emphasis on home ownership for those who would have had trouble making down payments, et cetera, which you talked about early in your time at HUD?
I think that subprime lending often got talked about in the same breath as predatory lending. And I think it was part of what I try to do is point out that there was a terrible thing called predatory lending, although subprime lending was not always unanimous with the other. If I had to say mea culpa, something that I think was not in retrospect was probably mistaken, was the idea that people could buy homes with little or no down payment. And so President Bush and I, acting on his behalf, I guess, as his housing secretary, we promoted the American Dream Down Payment Initiative, which was a way for folks to be helped with their down payment. I think the intentions behind that were noble. However, I think looking back on that kind of incentivizing of purchasing of homes with people who really had very little skin in the game could predictably then lead to the kinds of problems we see now with foreclosures. So, I don't know if I get to your question. You might come back at me because I'm not sure I'll fully answer what you asked, but I really believe that there was a place for subprime lending. However, I was never a mortgage underwriter, and I don't presume to know what the distinction is between an irresponsible lending and subprime lending. And obviously a lot of that has not worked out well in the aftermath of all the things that we've seen over the last couple of years.
Can I just ask you to clarify, when you were talking about incentivizing, inadvertently incentivizing, just tell me a little bit more about what you think about that. How did you see that?
You mean with a down payment?
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea was that the obstacle to home ownership for many, particularly among minority families, which was the focus began in the Clinton administration and continued by ours, that more minority families should, you know, enjoy the dream of home ownership and all of the beneficial things that came to individuals, to families, and to communities from home ownership is just something that we believe was part of the American dream. So if the obstacle was the inability to put together a down payment, and then we could somehow help people on a targeted basis to meet that down payment, then they could too become a homeowner. The idea was that the value of the home every year would increase as it had for decades in the American experience, and that would be something that would help a family acquire the kind of wealth that could take a family into the fullness of the American dream or living the life of the middle class America. And so the idea was to provide that little bridge to get people into home ownership. Now, obviously, you would still need to have income that was appropriately checked and reported, and a whole lot of other things that went into underwriting that we now know were irresponsibly not being done as mortgages were being written.
Thank you.
Melania.
I wonder if I can stay on this path of sort of early housing policy carried forward by you. One of the problems that shows up among investigators of a certain piece of the crisis is that with the Community Reinvestment Act, and I think it's also true for other pieces of legislation, you can't actually look at the mortgage data and figure out what mortgages were extended as part of Community Reinvestment Act initiatives, even though the banks would identify parts of their actions as Community Reinvestment Act motivated. And I wonder whether that doesn't surprise you as a policymaker. I mean, you'd think that the government would want to take credit for all they've done. Are you surprised to learn that the data can't be broken out by CRA, and did you ever come across that?
I did not come across it, and I find it shocking that it cannot. If it were conceived that you would put that mandate on banks and then not be able to track it, I'm surprised by that. But no, that's not something I ever dealt with. Now, I mean, I realize that CRA imposes tough standards on the banks.
You think that's something that ought to be fixed?
I think we ought to have a recognition that only good credit ought to be provided loans, and no matter where they reside, we ought to not be lending the bad credit. And that's a problem because inherently in poorer communities, you're going to find poorer credit risk. And so I don't know how we can ask banks to be solvent and be prudent and judicious and then also require that they lend money to bad risk. I mean, every risk in a poor neighborhood is not a bad risk. I don't know. I'm getting a little far afield here from anything I know too much about, but I have to say that it is troubling to have a CRE standard and then expect banks to behave responsibly all the time.
Thanks, Ron.
Senator, just this is flashing forward, I guess, to those fateful days in September and October. I forgot, forgive me, that you were in the Senate at that point in time. Could you reflect on what it's like to have the Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Federal Reserve come up to the Hill with the, dire, maybe understated predictions and descriptions, asking for extraordinary powers at the time?
I can remember the most dramatic time of this was a Sunday afternoon that I got asked to fly back, and I remember being in a conference room with maybe another four or five senators, with Secretary Paulson and Chairman Bernanke, and having them lay out for us the starkest of scenarios. And I just remember thinking, Armageddon. I mean, I remember thinking this is the worst of times. And the thing that was most frightening about it is that even with them asking for extraordinary powers, that they were not at all assured that they could prevent the kind of financial disaster that I think really was greater than the Great Depression in terms of the worldwide scope of it and, all that it could mean. So I think it was a very sobering time. And I do not believe that they were exaggerating for the sake of getting a goal accomplished. I believe that they, in the depths of their souls, believed exactly what they were telling us. And obviously, to a person like myself, I think you think, wow, if these guys that are in the middle of it and hold the titles that they hold believe this to be as dark as they're painting it, it must be pretty darn dark.
Can I build on that? I'm really curious, within the banking committee, sort of as you went into 2007, 2008 and the clouds got darker. Sort of where, what did it feel like in terms of an emerging sense of, gee, we got real problems here, until you got to that conference room and Bernanke and Paulson?
I think there was a slow acknowledgement of it all. I think it came up pretty quickly on all of us. I don't think that we were anticipating that we were in as big a problem. I mean, I think everyone anticipated a slowing of the economy. It was viewed as, I think, largely the housing market had kind of collapsed a bit, and there was a decline. We were clearly in or heading into a recession, but, you know, recessions come and go, and I don't think there was any understanding of the depth of the crisis until the financial, the credit, as I recall, Paulson explaining it time and again, was that the credit markets are frozen. They have frozen up. And there is no confidence. And the problem, of course, was all these counterparty risks that intertwine everyone into a deeper mess. And so I think that all kind of erupted at a moment in time. Not that there weren't clouds in the horizon about a recession and a housing downturn, but those didn't take the nature of a colossal global-wide financial meltdown. That became apparent in a matter of a short time.
In the crisis, as people understood suddenly the markets were frozen, did partisanship disappear?
Well, pretty much. Yeah, I think there was a sense that this was a big crisis. I mean, I give Chris Dodd high marks for working in a very bipartisan fashion. Senator Shelby, the ranking in the banking committee, was kind of an outlier in that he wasn't going to support any sort of government intervention. And I think that that's unpopular, and I don't give Senator Shelby anything but high marks when it comes to being astute politically, but while that might be politically unpopular, it was clear to me that it was necessary to be done. And, everyone has their point of view, and it's sincerely held, and I don't question that, but I think that beyond Senator Shelby, that there was a fairly strong consensus among those of us in the banking committee that we had to act, and we had to act swiftly. And, by the way, decisively enough, to create the kind of impact that we had to have psychologically. If the actions were not bold and decisive and clear and all of that we might be taking the steps but not having the desired effect.
Do you remember your reaction when the first TARP vote failed in the House?
I was very dismayed. I was very surprised. And obviously a lot of, in the House, it was, I guess, not the same sense of bipartisanship. There never is. And a lot of Republicans voted against it. If that vote had to be taken today, I don't think it would have passed or come near passage. But obviously it's a lot of water under the bridge and a lot of billions and trillions under the bridge, too. So I think the credibility of the administration is not what it was in those days, or the prior administration, even when it came to these issues. So I think, I remember being very, very distressed and disappointed and wondering what in the world we're going to do now. But I remember also Secretary Paulson coming back and just suffering through meetings and meetings in the House side with a lot of my fellow Republicans and whatnot, and all that back and forth that went on for days until finally we began to see a turn that indicated that we would be able to pass TARP. Let me say, by the way, that I voted for it and would play the music today if I had to for my vote, but I do believe that in retrospect we probably should have put some different guidelines on the vote that would not have diminished the impact of it, but would have created the far-flung uses of TARP since then. It was never intended for us to utilize it to bail out an automotive company that was in trouble.
Nobody imagined, I think, in September of 2008.
Pardon me?
At the time it was written, I don't think anyone could have imagined, right, that you would be using it for money to destroy.
Right, right. And I think there should have been, a little tighter control of a broader use of the funds, and continuing back and forth to Congress. I think we gave too broad a grant.
Senator, can I just ask you, during that period of time with the TARP votes, because you had been in the cabinet, I'm just curious, did you talk to anyone in the White House, Josh or?
Oh, sure, I'm sure I talked to Josh. Or may have talked to the president, I'm not sure. I think I mean, he didn't pick up the phone and call me, I don't think. But I think I may have been with him at something where he talked, where we talked, it seems like. But I would have talked to Josh. I would have talked to his deputy. What is his name? I'm forgetting.
Joel. Joel Kaplan.
Joel. Yeah. I talked to Joel a lot. I talked to Joel. Joel was on the Hill a lot during those days, and I would talk to Joel frequently.
Thank you.
One last set of questions. Somebody has asked us to ask about the role of the Federal Reserve as a regulator, not the monetary policy side. And clearly, Chairman Greenspan's reputation has suffered, and he has had the good grace to actually say, hey, you know, along with a lot of other people, I made some mistakes. I'm curious whether you have a perception over the years you were on the Banking Committee of how effective a regulator the Fed was in terms of looking after safety and soundness of these big institutions.
Well, I don't think that Chairman Greenspan felt like the Fed had the ability to provide a regulatory oversight over the GSEs.
Right.
I think if he had, he would have, because I know it concerned him greatly. So I think the problem is that we did not have an overall financial regulator that regulated all of the financial institutions that had morphed and evolved since the 30s, when was the last time that we revamped all of this. Clearly, the Fed's role as a consumer protector, if you will, probably gets poor marks. We now have, I wasn't there to vote on this, but you know, we may have fixed it with the new consumer advocate in the position. I'm not so sure, you know, how wise that is or how far that should go. But anyway, no, I don't really think I know how to fix the Fed. And but clearly, they did not have regulatory powers that were broad enough to provide them the ability to touch into the GSEs.
Okay. Thank you. This has been exceedingly, we appreciate your really thoughtful answers. And
thank you very much. Okay, good luck with your work.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.